Welcome to Christian Life Academy, chapter 19. We're beginning today, which is of the law of God. So, of course, we just finished our 125-part chapter 1. No, we finished chapter 1. We went back to chapter 1 of the scriptures, and we just finished that online. I think I'm hoping that you got something out of that. It's hard not to. There's so much information there, and it is all available on Sermon Audio, of course. You can go to Sermon Audio and you can recommend people go there to hear it if you want them to hear it, that kind of thing. So it's all available on Sermon Audio. And we do have a lot of people that do listen through Sermon Audio. So I give a shout out right now to the people on Sermon Audio. That doesn't seem right, does it? But at any rate, yeah, we do have a lot of people in England and California, New Jersey, who all listen to our messages, surprisingly. But at any rate, so if you're in New Jersey or California or England and you're listening, welcome. We're glad to have you with us. Anyway, chapter 19 of the Law of God. Now, you've got an outline. I sent out the outline to you. So, of course, that's how we break it down when we go through it in class. And some of it, as you'll see as we go through, is very simple. The phrases and the bullet points, even there's like one point under some of these outline points, and others we'll break down and spend a little bit more time on. So let's, first of all, in way of introduction, you'll note that this chapter is harmonious with the same chapters in the Westminster Confession, which of course is the Confession for Presbyterians, and the Savoy Declaration, which is the Confession for Congregationalists. The three major Protestant, or let's just say true confessions, the ones that are not Roman Catholic, are the three: 1689 Second London Baptist Confession, the Westminster Confession, the Savoy Declaration. They are very similar in most chapters. Obviously, we digress, right? We cover baptism. That's different for us than it is for Presbyterians who believe in infant baptism, and they tie that in with the covenant. But this chapter of the Law of God is the same in all three confessions. There is no difference. Now, we've already talked about some of those chapters where we are different, and there's going to be more that we're going to see, but don't believe the skeptic who asserts, now this is important, this is why I'm bringing this up in the introduction, who asserts that the divines wrote the 1689 simply conformed to their brothers. In other words, that the guys that were involved with the 1689 Second London Baptist Confession, they just conformed and they gave in to the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. Not true. We see all these other chapters where there is divergence. The reason that it's the same is because this doctrine, all the Puritan reformers were unified. They held strongly to it. Oh, got a little low there. They held strongly to it. So the issue is not that they just copied it over and we don't embrace these things. No, we do embrace these things. Now, you say, well, that sounds a little bit for what you're giving some foreshadowing there. What? Why do you bring it up like a defense right off the bat? That's because there's a lot of questions here. Now, what it says here that you can partially see and you can't see the rest is that there's been great misunderstanding discerning the law. I got it right here. And that existed from the very beginning of the church. There's been a lot of problems. We see this addressed in the New Testament. There are many questions to answer. Here's some of the questions, including these. What is the relationship of the Christian and the law? Right? That's a basic question. What is that? What is the law still in effect today? Must we obey it? Are the Ten Commandments the law or more or less than them? Is there more than the Ten Commandments? Is that it? Is there less than the Ten Commandments? What is it? Is obedience to the law equal with works? In other words, is obeying the law works? So now we're talking about works salvation? Is the moral law binding on all people, just Christians or no one? Did Christ, in fulfilling the law, end the law? Isn't God a God of love, not law? You heard that before? Wasn't the law for the Old Testament and not the New Testament church? Now, if you don't recognize all of them, you should probably recognize some of them because these are questions that Christians are dealing with and debating, frankly. And there's been great division over these questions. So you'll see what the confession actually stipulates, the position that we hold, and you'll see some of the reasoning of why that is the case. And I think that you'll agree that it's the same thing we see over and over again, that you have to believe this for the gears to mesh. The gears of doctrine and scripture don't work correctly if you try to change this up. You got a problem. You got to go through some serious calisthenics, I like to say, scriptural calisthenics, to make it work in a different way. Okay, so first of all, let's talk through some definitions and concepts of law. And if you've been in my constitutional law course, some of this will sound very familiar to you because I've extracted part of it from there. Because it's good information to understand more about the law and some of the concepts of law, and we're going to see those specifically in the confession as we go. First of all, what are some definitions of law from Webster's 1828 American Dictionary? And by the way, the reason that we quote from Webster's 1828 is because, first of all, it was not actually revisionist history. So that was the definition of what it meant. It's how they perceived it. It's how they looked at it. This is the dictionary that was authoritative in the United States immediately after our founding. This is what they thought these words meant. This is also the dictionary that is still in publication today that is closest to the major English translations. This is it. First definition, a rule, particularly an established or permanent rule, prescribed by the supreme power of a state to its subjects for regulating their actions, particularly their social actions. Laws are imperative or mandatory, commanding what shall be done, and prohibitory, restraining from what is to be forborne, or permissive, declaring what may be done without incurring a penalty. The laws which enjoin the duties of piety and morality are prescribed by God and found in the scriptures. Law is beneficence acting by rule. Now, that's not a definition you'll see in Webster's, Merriam-Webster's dictionary today. They do not bring in God and his sovereignty over law. But if you understand the concepts of what it's saying, there's kind of laws take two different, they take three different forms. One is that they say you have to do this. They're mandatory. One is prohibiting you. You can't do this. And then one is saying here, and the third one is saying, okay, here's what you can do and no more. In other words, if you do more, then you incur a penalty. That's what that's saying there. So three ways that law really work. Number two, municipal law is a rule of civil conduct prescribed by the supreme power of a state, commanding what its subjects are to do and prohibiting what they are to forbear, a statute. Municipal or civil laws are established by the decrees, edicts, or ordinances of absolute princes, as emperors and kings, or by the formal acts of a legislature of free states. So it's a statute. So a law, by the way, you can see, usually is, this is the first definition, gives us some idea of what kind of law there can be. The second definition actually dictates the municipal law or statute law that exists in a state or in a government. When it says a state, by the way, it's meaning government. Does that make sense? Law of nature is a rule of conduct arising out of the natural relations of human beings established by the Creator and existing prior to any positive precept. Thus, it is a law of nature that one man should not injure another, and murder and fraud would be crimes independent of any prohibition from a supreme power. So what is this saying? A law of nature, it's saying, is that arises out of the natural relations of human beings established by the Creator. Who's the Creator? God. And exists prior to any positive precept. What does that mean? Written law. Established law. So they existed prior to that. Did the Ten Commandments, for instance, exist prior to Cain killing Abel? No. Was it still wrong for Cain to kill Abel? Yes, of course it was. That's natural law. Okay. Laws of nations. We're skipping a few here that just really define a few more municipal laws. Laws of nations are rules, the rules that regulate the mutual intercourse of nations and states. These rules depend on natural law or the principles of justice which sprang from the social state, and they are founded on customs, compacts, treaties, leagues, and agreements between independent communities. Now, this is almost a half a freebie here because law of nations is not something we're going to talk about or cover, but just to let you understand, law of nations is actually in our Constitution in two different places. It's referenced, the law of nations, and ask your congressman, you want to play stump the dummy with your congressman at a town hall meeting sometime, ask him where the law of nations is defined. He can't answer that because the law of nations isn't defined anywhere. In fact, if you were to say who's the one that defines it the best, you could say it was Puffendorf, Samuel Puffendorf, and his work in the 1700s is probably the closest we can get. And here's essentially what Puffendorf says. Law of nations is the Sermon on the Mount applied to nations. That's what he says. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love God first, then love your neighbor as yourself. That's the law of nations. So when you're considering how one nation should relate to another, you want to make sure that you're treating them properly. You're not trying to take advantage of them for your own benefit. You're trying to make it fair. You're trying to make it fair. Does that make sense? And they should be doing the same for you. So does that mean it's okay for you to go slap your neighbor state, your neighbor nation, just going to go over there and, you know, crack up on the side of the head in Canada? No. And I don't mean, you know, that you're going to go to the border and actually crack a Canadian on the head. I'm saying, would it be okay for us to just say, hey, Canada, guess what? Now you're part of us. Start, send your taxes in to, Ottawa. Send it down to Washington now. Even though I have thought through that several times. Anyway, no. So the point is that you can't do that. Why? It's a violation of the law of nature, God's law. And that law of nature is applied to the law of nations when we talk about the relation between nations. It was in the dictionary back then, not anymore. Moral law, a law which prescribes to men their religious and social duties, in other words, their duties to God and to each other. The moral law is summarily contained in the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments, written by the finger of God on two tables of stone and delivered to Moses on Mount Sinai. Not in Webster's today. Not in Webster's today. By the way, in the future, I will actually put up here the current definition of moral law, because moral law is in the dictionary, but that's not it. That's not how they define it anymore. So, at any rate, this is what Webster's dictionary, how Webster's dictionary defined law. Now, let's just talk about a couple of concepts. First of all, there's two types of law. You saw them referenced basically here, but you're going to see that we're going to look at them in the confession. It's going to reference these in the confession. Common law or natural law is one type. Common law or natural law is one type. The other is revealed law or moral law. So, at any rate, common law or natural law is the law God built into creation, including man. Also called the law of nature or the law of the land or sea. You ever heard of that? That's the law of the land. What are we talking about? Common law. That's what we're talking about. Psalm 19 confirms the law of nature was written in man's conscience prior to man's fall and is common to all men. That which is written on their hearts. We see Paul say it. Christ says it. It's mentioned over and over again in Scripture that God's law is written on our hearts. We're going to see some of those verses a little bit later this morning. Reformed Baptist theologian Richard Barcelo, I thought this was a pretty good quote, writing concerning the substance of the moral law, said this: Protestant scholasticism taught that the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments, right? The Decalogue and the Ten Commandments is the same thing, summarily contain the moral law and is an inscripturated form of the natural law as to its substance. A distinction was made between substance and form. Substance is one, form and function may vary. For example, when the Westminster Larger Catechism, question 98, says the moral law is summarily comprehended in Ten Commandments, it refers to the fact that the substance or the underlying essence of the moral law is assumed and articulated in the propositions of the Decalogue as contained in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. The form and function fits the redemptive historical circumstances in which it was given. The substance or underlying principles are always relevant and applicable to man because he is created in the image of God. The application may shift based on redemptive historical changes, such as the inauguration of the new covenant, but its substance and utility never change. So here's what he's saying. He's saying, look, the moral law has been in place because we are created in the image of God. The moral law is in place on us, period. The Ten Commandments were the articulation of those principles of moral law. Why? God wanted to be very, we're going to see those verses. God wanted to be very clear about exactly what the moral law was and not leave it to interpretation. Did people know anyway that they shouldn't steal? Yes. Did they know they shouldn't commit adultery? Yes. Did they know that all these? Yes, absolutely they did. We're going to see those verses. Prior to the Ten Commandments, all those, at least six of the commandments mentioned specifically that somebody said, why did you do that? Or you shouldn't have done that. We're going to see that. Lisa. Absolutely.
Because there are some proofs, because some tribes were peaceful, but then the others were warring against them.
Right. Sinful. Sinful men. So they did it. Cannibals, too. Now, it's interesting, you know, this is a good example of revisionist history. I just heard this not too long ago where there was a group of Indians who, in a certain town you might know, and this group of Indians, their perspective on history is completely revised. Now, first of all, let me just tell you, just so that you understand this, the Indians had no written language. The Indians of the Americas, all the way from Eskimos down to South America, had no written records. None. Not the Indians. Now, the Aztecs did. The Mayans did. But the Indians are not the same people. They did not. Who was the one that actually first started writing their history? White man. White man. So when a group of Indians today says, well, we've existed for 10,000 years here. No, you didn't. They have no idea if they existed or not. There's no evidence. There's no stories. There's no history. There's no books. There's no videos. There's no 8-track tapes. There's nothing to say this. Now, what this group said recently that I heard was they talked about how, well, if you go back to 5 to 10,000 years, all people across the earth were cannibals. What? How do you possibly come up with that? But that's what their statement was. Now, that would be completely ignoring the natural law written on man's hearts. Now, by the way, we have written histories of 5 to 10,000 years ago, at least 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago. As a matter of fact, we have some written history. There is no written history of 10,000 years because we didn't exist at 10,000 years ago. There was no 10,000 years ago. Let's not go down the creation path too far. All right, so here is the other type of law, right? So we had common or natural law, and now here is the moral law or revealed law. Is that which is written in the Bible, also called the law, called the revelation or the law of God, specifically in the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue, which is the substance of the natural law. The Ten Commandments are the summary and essence of the moral law, but doesn't contain all the moral laws. So if you understand the concept here, we refer to it as different types of law. It's the same law. Do you see this? We're saying two types of law because we're saying that there's natural law or common law, that which is not articulated, that which is built into creation, and then there is the law that's actually been articulated, which confirms the essence of the natural law. Make sense? We'll go on and break it down further. Don't worry. All right, laws may be written from two opposing philosophies. Two opposing philosophies. First, negative law. It's limited law, produces greater liberty for the individual, limiting civil government. So we talked about this in the definitions of law, and this is the one that the law is written to say you can't do this. Right? You can't do this. Prohibitory. Now, if the only law you have is prohibitory, you have freedom. Why? Because you can do everything else. Do you see what I mean? The other type, or the other philosophy, is positive law. That's permissive law. Operates by permit, toleration, or government-granted privileges. God wrote the Ten Commandments as negative law. If the commandments had been given in positive form, it would have been permit law, or law that defines what people can do, giving rise to a large civil government. The philosophy of law that built America was thus negative, wherein that which built Rome was positive. The former gave birth to the greatest amount of freedom people have ever experienced since the time of Christ. The latter has always been known for its tyranny. Sadly, today in America, we have returned to Roman law, giving rise to permission or permits to practice liberty. This may be shocking for you, but in Rome, you had to receive a permit from the Roman government to drive your chariot in the street. Is that hard to believe? Jacob, can you believe that? Yeah. In Rome, you had to have permission from the government to build a home. That's shocking, isn't it? Why would anyone need permission to use their property in the way they wanted to use their property? And if he was here, we would hear an amen from the owner of the Lapeer International Dragway or drag strip. There you go. Have to have a permit to have a campfire. That's Roman law. That's the opposite of where we're at. So you understand the idea, right? So if we were to actually write our laws, so here's the problem. We have a blend. which is the worst possible thing for people, is to have a blend where we have some things that says you can't do these things, and then we have other things that say you must do these things, right? And we've blended it to say you can't do these things unless we say you can do those things. Do you see this? So you must pay your property taxes. You must pay your property taxes, but you cannot have a campfire unless we say you can have a campfire. So you're going to pay for the privilege of owning property, but you can't use your property the way that you want to use your property whenever you want to use your property. You have to get our permission to do that. Now, if anyone knows anything about tax law, you know that that's like the worst iteration of it. Now, first of all, let's just clarify. There is no such thing as tax law. There is no tax laws in the United States. You got me? I'm way off of the side of the pulpit. This is definitely in freebie territory. There is no, it's the tax code. It's the tax code. Now, here's when the IRS starts calling a tax law, when they're taking you to court. But a law has to be passed by the legislature and signed by the president. None of the tax law, or quote unquote, is. It's all regulations imposed by the IRS. Talk about taxation without representation? That's where you're at. That's where you're at. The government does not have legislation that allows them to tax you, but they do. But that was all freebie. Here's the point. It's impossible for you to be able to properly follow the U.S. tax code. It's so huge that no matter what you do, they can find a way to say you did the wrong thing. The code contradicts itself. You don't have to do this here. You have to do this here. Same thing. Just puts it in two different places. It's impossible. Look, if you don't know this yet, I'm sad to say this in the United States. If the government doesn't like you, they already have the reasons to go after you. They can just go after you. You can say, well, yeah, but that's going to violate my constitutional rights. You're correct. Good luck with that. But there's no way the courts could handle the kind of suits that would be brought against the government if people actually started to say, you don't have the right to do that constitutionally. We couldn't handle it. We can't handle the cases that we have right now in the federal court system. But that's where we're at. So this is all about the law. You understand that? We're talking about how the law works. It's all going to go back to God's law. But that's how far we've digressed today. Michelle. Is he in some trouble again?
He is preparing to
do
the government.
Oh, good.
Wrongful prosecution?
Which it was.
Yep,
now, it'll be a miracle if the judge will actually hear the case. You know, and that's where the federal courts are, by the way. You know, it doesn't just because you have a valid case doesn't mean they have to accept it. The court actually has to receive your documentation, but they never have to hear it. They can just dismiss it outright. Never sees the light of day. That's where most cases, by the way, to the national government, that's where they go. Most cases are never heard by a U.S. magistrate. They're dismissed outright. They don't, and their excuse is, easily, we don't have time. It's true, but that's not right, is it? So, anyway, he was wrongfully prosecuted. At any rate, all right, so now I'm going to give you something else that's half of a freebie, but also applicable. And this is the chart of what I call the Hebrew Constitution. It was actually called that by Paul Jaley, and so I put it into this format so it was easy to understand. But the chart of the Hebrew Constitution. So did the nation of Israel have a constitution in their national archives, which was immediately adjacent to the temple in Jerusalem, and where they displayed their constitution? No, first of all, they didn't have a national archives. But second, they did not have this. But if you were to look at the laws that govern the nation of Israel, it could easily be called their constitution. By the way, England's constitution was never called their constitution until they completely rewrote it in the 1800s. Before that, it was called their constitution by Daniel, don't say, because you're a cheat. Does anybody know who first called the English laws that made up their constitution? Anybody else? Wait, Jenny, don't give me, I see that grin. John Adams, and he did it in the trial on the men in the Boston Massacre. He defended the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre, and that's where he referred to England's Constitution. And what he was talking about was these documents that basically were the basis of their law, the common law, the Magna Carta, and the Petition of Rights. That's what he was talking about. So those documents he coined as the England Constitution. That stuck. And in fact, in the 1800s, when they actually wrote a constitution, they started by taking those documents and then putting them together and coming up with a formal constitution. So if you were to do that for the nation of Israel, this is where you would go. You would start with part one as the fundamental law or the Ten Commandments. So this would be, there are, and you know, if you're not familiar with this already, just to make sure you understand, the Ten Commandments were written on two tablets of stone. Each tablet represents one aspect of your relationship. The first tablet is your relationship with God. The second tablet is your relationship with man. My pen right here, actually, I think this one has it right. No, this one has it wrong. So you see this is a Ten Commandments pen that's right here on my lapel, sideways. There. It looked like a B. Now, okay, it looks right. This is wrong. This is historically inaccurate, but this is the way you see it a lot of times. You'll see, this is ironic to me that we even do it this way. Roman numerals. You know, God did not write it in Roman numerals. At any rate, it was Hebrew. You'll see 1 through 5, and then you'll see 6 through 10. In fact, a lot of times you'll just see that reference, and that's supposed to mean the Ten Commandments, right? And it has, historically. That has been the case. In fact, almost every state house, U.S. government buildings, et cetera, where you see the Ten Commandments in artwork, you'll see 1 through 5, and you'll see 6 through 10. There's Roman numerals on two tablet-shaped objects. If you go to the U.S. court building, the federal court building in Detroit, and you can get a tour of the what's called the $1 million courtroom, which you'd think is not a lot of money, and it wasn't. It's not a lot of money today, right? $1 million courtroom, that doesn't seem like that's a, except go back to 1925. $1 million courtroom is unbelievable. It's from the original U.S. courthouse in Detroit that they moved. They had the money to move it into the new courthouse, and you can get a tour and see it. And I've been there. It's very impressive. You've been there. I know at least. I don't know about you guys. I don't know about Jake and Jenny. You guys, Jake and Jenny, you guys were there. Anyway, they have all kinds of carvings in the wood. And on the doors, they have the Ten Commandments. They have the Ten Commandments. How do we know that? Because it's the shape and it's the Roman numerals 1 through 10. That's how we know. The guide who took us through said that's just a reference to ancient law. Not Ten Commandments? I don't know. Not Ten Commandments. At any rate, Moses holding them? No, that's not the thing. All right, so first table is the relationship with us to God, the first four. By the way, the first four commandments and the last 10 in Hebrew, according to what is actually stipulated in Exodus, are the same number of Hebrew characters. They would have fit equally on two tablets. At any rate, so the first four commandments, no God, no other gods. It served as the preamble, the source of law. God is sovereign. Jehovah, Yahweh, is sovereign. Commandment number two, no graven images. Well, that protected one's right of worship and the right of assembly and petition. You can't meet together to worship God unless you have the right to meet together to worship God, unless you have the right to bring your petitions to him in prayer. You see where we get some ideas of our source of our liberties? Right off the bat. No, not take the name of God in vain. Protected the right of vows, voluntary association. Look, if you can't trust somebody's word, if everybody's lying all the time, you got a problem interacting with people, don't you? You got a big problem interacting with people. Not using God's name in vain gives you a standard to hold to. You wouldn't use God's name. You wouldn't say, I swear in God's name that this is true if it wasn't true. Why? Because you would be inviting God's vengeance on you if you were lying. Think it means anything today? Not for most. Not profane the Sabbath, protected the right to work. 14% of the time goes to the Lord. Don't idolize work. Where had that? Now, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but think about for the Hebrews what that really meant. They were in a position where they had to work 7 days in Egypt. There was no weekend. There was no Sabbath. There was not a day of rest. So having the Sabbath day actually protected the right to work without becoming a slave to work. It means more than that. We're going to break it down. Okay, the second table of the law, which is civil liberty, your relationship with others. Honor your father and mother protects the family's liberty to properly train their children. If the children do not have to honor their father and their mother, they don't have to listen to their father and their mother, how can they be trained? How can they become good citizens? They cannot. Hence, Western culture today, where disciplining children has become not only looked down upon, but in some cases, illegal. Illegal. So what happens when you have children who are not disciplined? They become undisciplined adults. And they do all kinds of horrible things. Right? You remember the kids at Columbine. Guess what both parents taught their kids? Evolution, atheism, and no discipline. Both cases. One of the t-shirts was survival of the fittest you wore when he did the shootings. Look, if you embrace that philosophy, you should not have a problem with them killing other kids. Now, you know, say that to somebody. Say that to somebody who's an atheist. And you say, well, so you think it's okay for those kids at Columbine to want to kill the other kids, right? Of course I don't think that. Wait a minute. You're contradicting your own moral philosophy. Because if you believe in survival of the fittest, then you shouldn't have a problem with somebody who kills somebody else. That's survival of the fittest, is it not? No. You know why they say they have a problem with it? Because God's law is written on their heart. That's why. God's law, they're proving natural law is true. Because they got a problem with it. Do not kill. Protect an individual life and the right of personal self-defense. Look, if God says you can't kill and someone's trying to kill you, you have the right to stop them. Why? Because they're trying to destroy the image of God. They don't get to decide. God decides. Why is suicide a sin? Because you don't get to decide when your life is going to be ended. It's up to God. Your life is not yours. It's His. And by the way, it doesn't matter if you agree with that or not. It's still true. So if unbelievers don't agree with that, it's still true. Very hard. It's too late. They can ask forgiveness when they're standing before God. Too late. Too late. No adultery. Protecting the liberty of marriage and the individual rights of men and women in the home. If you can't trust your spouse to be faithful to you through that, you're going to have a problem with relationships in general. You had a question, sir? Is this a rabbit trail?
Not really.
Okay. No. Nope, not implying that. So the question was, if a believer committed suicide, are they not forgiven for that? All sins of all believers are forgiven by Christ's death on the cross, committed and yet to be committed. They're all forgiven. That's a good question. But I was not trying to imply that. All right. Doug sent me down that path, by the way. Do not steal. Protected private property and the right to a local speedy trial with restitution. We see that in the Decalogue, in the statute laws that follow in Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Not stealing implies you have the right to own property. How can someone steal from you if it's not yours? You see this? So there's some Christian groups that will say, oh no, none of us really should own anything. We should all just put everything in common and nobody should own anything. That's not what God says. It's not what God says. And if that was the case, why wouldn't Cain just go and take one of Abel's sheep? It goes way back, doesn't it? No false witness protects the liberty of one's reputation to be innocent until proven guilty. Like, if you can't trust people to say the truth about you, all society breaks down. Because everybody is always claiming everybody. Look, when you get into real, very totalitarian states, and you can think of like China today is not quite there. North Korea is. China, by the way, not a totalitarian state today. They're communists, but they're not totalitarian. Totalitarian would be North Korea, where you have one guy who is running the country with no checks whatsoever. China does have checks. China does have checks. Not that they're good. Not that they're right. But North Korea is a good example. There's been others. Iraq under Saddam Hussein was one of those. Right? It was very totalitarian. Now, what happens in those? Well, they actually maintain their power through fear. They maintain their power through fear. How do they do it? Anybody who even there's a suggestion that they're out of line disappears. They go away. Whether it's prison, whether it's death, that's it. There's no question. There's no outside source that's actually going to come in and say, you can't do that. That's it. Think about North Korea. Does the United Nations have any say on North Korea about whether or not it's right for them to imprison people? No, they don't even let them come in to find out who's in prison or put to death. Zero. They operate completely by fear. Nazi Germany got to that point, right? Think about Nazi Germany. What they were telling everybody all the time to do was tell on your neighbor. Tell on your neighbor, right? And when that happens, you have a huge problem because then people start telling on people because they don't like them. Right? That problem with people against each other just starts to become like a big snowball. Michelle. It can be. It can be. So in a very strong dictatorship that is not beneficent, yes. So you can have a dictatorship that's a beneficent dictatorship. In other words, that it's a good dictator. Right? So, and that would be like the same as a king who is a good king, right? Or, but you could also have a king who is a tyrant. Does that make sense? Now that's, and of course, that's moving toward more totalitarian. Now when it happens for everything, then there'll be a problem. It'll disintegrate quickly. It has to. That's where that leads eventually. What it leads to very quickly is that people become so afraid of everyone else that they begin to find ways to either get out of the system or break the system. That's what happens. They undermine the system because they know the system is a problem. Doug. Well, that is, of course, an amendment. It's one of the Bill of Rights, the right to a local and speedy trial. But as almost everything in the Bill of Rights, the government has found a way to make a loophole and drag that out. But let's not be mistaken. There are still people that sue the national government because they violated that. They sue state and local governments because they violated that. So that does still happen. You know, you probably, I don't know if you remember hearing Mickey talk about this. He has talked about this before, that, you know, he works at the county jail. Well, the county jail is supposed to be where they go until their trial. Well, he said people for years there that were waiting for their trial. In fact, I remember the guy he told me was the longest. It was almost 10 years. And it was for rape. It was almost 10 years. You know, they had almost caught him red-handed. They had DNA evidence. I mean, the fact that they had delayed it was baffling. But the guy finally did go to trial after 10 years. I don't remember which way they found him, but anyway, you're right. That's definitely been ignored. Do not covet. Protect one's property from the unlawful desires of others through due process, confrontation, and an impartial jury of one's peers. So we often talk about what is the difference between coveting and stealing. And they say, well, stealing is when you take it, coveting is when you want it. That's true. But there is more to it than that, because when you want it through coveting, then you begin to plot. So if you want something and you're going to go get it, that's stealing. If you want something and you're going to find a way to use the government to get it, that's coveting. Are you with me? And then when the government, by the way, takes it, they stole. So it's all related. All right, so that's part one of the fundamental law, the Ten Commandments. Part two would be statute law. Now, we saw that in the definitions. This is case law or principles in practice with equity. So these are just a few selected examples from Exodus and Deuteronomy. You can see the references. We're not going to turn to them, but let's just mention it. Modesty in worship is in Exodus 20. What does that refer to? It's an application of the Second Commandment. It's an application of the Second Commandment, which is What? What's the second commandment? But hold on. I'm not going to embarrass you. I'm not going to ask that question. I withdraw the question. Because here's what I want to say. You should know the Ten Commandments. You should know the Ten Commandments. I'm not saying you have to have every word memorized from Deuteronomy or Exodus, but you should know that two is idols, graven images. Modesty in worship is an application of the second commandment. So let's look at this as a pyramid. Although I hate to use that as, let's say a triangle. Top down, right? What's the greatest commandment? Christ says it. What is it? No? Yeah, love God with all your heart and all your strength. That's number one, right? Number two is like unto the first. Love your neighbor as yourself. What's he say? All the laws hang from these two. Remember, we just talked about two tablets of the law. What were they? One is your relationship to God. One is your relationship to man. The two. You see this? Now, you say, well, okay, that's it. Really? So is it okay to smack somebody around? How about kidnapping? How about rape? Well, if that's the two laws, and then that's the ten explained, where do they go? Glad you ask. The Bible tells us this, but it all has to do with what the commandments are. It all has to do with what the commandments are. So these are some examples of how those things flow into those commandments. Modesty in worship is an application of the second commandment. Does God care how we worship him? He does. Abihu, Nadab and Abihu, they learned that the hard way. Struck dead in front of the whole nation of Israel for offering strange incense. Did they do something that God had not done? Did God say no incense? No, in fact, he did have incense. But God said, do this. And they did that. And you know what he did? He set an example. If I say do this, then do this. If I don't say to do that, then don't do that. Does God care? He cares. So modesty in worship is a reflection of the fact that he cares how we worship him. It's an application of the second commandment. Exodus, the next one you can see, is protection of women in marriage. That's a reflection of the seventh commandment. What's the seventh commandment? Adultery. That was kind of an easy, I knew where that was going there. That's good. The next one, murder, vengeance, kidnapping, assault, all refers to the sixth commandment. Those things are covered in that passage. Murder, vengeance, enacting vengeance on someone. Kidnapping, assault, all reflections of the sixth commandment. What's the sixth commandment? Thou shalt not kill. Next, honoring of parents is a reference to the fifth commandment, right? Honor your father and your mother. Restitution for property crimes is an application of the eighth commandment, not to steal. Sovereignty of God, the first commandment. Protection from greed, due process of law is the tenth commandment. Protection of witnesses, the ninth commandment, bearing false witness, right? Look, if people are afraid to tell the truth about you because they're afraid of vengeance, then that's not going to work. So there has to be some protection for someone who actually witnesses somebody doing something wrong and then is not going to be afraid to come out and say it. We have to protect them so that there's not a vengeance against them. Does that make sense? So that's why we have things like the Witness Protection Program, frankly, which actually is just a reflection of how bad our society has become, where we can't protect the witnesses. There isn't protection in general, so we have to hide them. That's the Witness Protection Program. They should call it the Witness Hiding Program. Protection of work of the fourth commandment, protection of vows, third commandment. Okay, so that's statute law. Part three, qualifications to hold civil office. All right, I've preached on this, not going to preach on this tonight, but there are biblical qualifications to hold civil office. Paul went through some of them in 1 Samuel recently, but here's where they are. Good character above reproach. If someone's going to be a leader, a civil leader, they're to have good character above reproach. By the way, what does reproach mean? What does above reproach mean to you? What does that mean? We're all commanded, by the way, to live lives that are above reproach. Jacob. That's it exactly. Above reproach would be that you're beyond questioning if you did anything wrong. You're above reproach. Look, this is why, for instance, a pastor who has an office should have a window. And if he's going to meet with a woman for counseling, there should be somebody outside that window. If he's going to go to someone's home There should be somebody with him. Why? So that he is above reproach. It's not a matter of saying that or insinuating that that pastor is going to do something wrong. It's a matter of him being in a position where he cannot even be questioned that it's the right thing or the wrong thing. Above reproach. You see this? Proven wisdom in applying principles of justice. He's not a novice, in other words. Unwilling to take a bribe. Won't buy or sell principles of justice. Welcome to lobbying. Obedient. You know, what's amazing to me about that is that now we've gone so far beyond that. It's hilarious to hear the Democrats fumbling, trying to come up with something to say that Trump took a bribe for something or offered a bribe to somebody, because there's been no evidence of it. But the joke of it is that they're all doing it all the time, and they're not even ashamed of it. Did you take that so many million dollars for your campaign from this organization that you just voted on or introduced legislation? Yes, I did. They're not afraid to say it. Why? Well, because I believe it's right. It had nothing to do with that money. I appreciate that they supported me like that because I'm a good candidate. I bring forth legislation on the right things, especially as far as my donors are concerned. Willing to conduct, obedience to the laws, no insurrection spirit. We should not have someone elected to office who goes to office to tear it down. Not according to the Bible. Willing to conduct investigations to make a just decision. Willing to conduct investigations to make a just decision. Let me give you the perfect example of how that's been violated. So you might be familiar with the story in the Boston area. Police responded to a call that there was a break-in happening. They got to the site. There was a black man climbing through a window. The black man that was climbing through the window was asked to get out. He was very belligerent to the police officers. The primary officer on the scene was of Hispanic descent. At any rate, he immediately called for backup. There were other officers that came on site, and they're questioning this guy, and he is just saying, leave me alone, mind your own business, I didn't do anything wrong. And then he started claiming that he lived there. And they said, okay, do you have some ID? Or give us your name, we can look it up. I don't need to give you my name, I don't need to do, this is exactly the tone he took, okay? So what happened? They arrested him. The neighbor across the street is the one that called it in. The guy was climbing through a window in the back of the house. He saw him. Well, what happened was the guy had locked himself out of his house, so he busted a window and climbed through the window. That's what he was doing, trying to do. And he owned the house. It was his. He refused to give the police any information. He refused to say anything else, and then he was basically started acting belligerent, so they arrested him. Now, as soon as they got him in and they started processing him and he said who he was, they recognized it, and they just said, why didn't you say this, you know? So, of course, he made a huge deal out of this. The president immediately said that the police acted stupidly. They should have never done that. Now, the police, of course, it was a big tizzy because then they had to come out and defend themselves of why their officer had done this. He, of course, got suspended. Did nothing wrong. Got suspended. Eventually, everything calmed down because the president invited them both to come to his house for a beer. The White House. Now, that every part of that's pathetic. Obama's actions. It's pathetic. But here's the point. He jumped to conclusions. That was not a just decision. He did not investigate it at all. He heard the hubbub on the media about it's a black man trying to come in, so they assumed he was breaking in. It wasn't because he was black. And it's ironic that there was an Hispanic man that was the police officer. Guess what? He's a minority too. Personally just, ruling in the fear of God. They should personally be just. Does it matter someone's character about how they serve an office? Of course it does. Of course it does. One who keeps his word and is consistent in his actions. Obviously someone who doesn't is not someone you can trust, which means you can't trust them to be in office. Fourth, principles of justice. We're just going to mention these and we'll end on this today. Justice must be, these are principles that are in God's word. Justice must be the ultimate goal. Whenever you're looking at a legal matter, the end goal needs to be justice. It's not to make somebody look bad or good. It's not to make somebody feel better. It should only be for justice. If there's no reason for it to go to the courts or to be heard in the gates as it was at that time, then it shouldn't come up. Does that make sense? We don't use the legal system just to make people feel a certain way. Justice has to be the goal. There can be no respecter of persons. All must go by the same rules. Is it okay for the king to get away with stuff and not others? Is it okay for congressmen to get away with stuff and not others? No, it's not okay. Happens all the time. I can think of a half a dozen examples that I normally teach on that I can mention right now. Congressional banking, all kinds of stuff. We won't go there. There must be two or three independent witnesses prior to convention. The biblical standard is that there has to be two witnesses. Now, we're way past that. People get convicted all the time based on circumstantial evidence. What is circumstantial evidence? It's that the evidence looks like they did it. Well, that's not God's standard. God's standard is two witnesses. So no matter what you think about if he's guilty or innocent, I think he was guilty, O.J. Simpson was properly found innocent of killing his former wife and her boyfriend. Why? There was not two witnesses. Now, if you say, well, there's DNA evidence that came out later, which there was, that's one witness. That's one. Say, well, that's not right. If somebody gets murdered and there's somebody else's blood there, or there's a fingerprint there, then they're guilty. Okay, sorry. You cannot elevate yourself to God. Because God says two. Now, do you know why God can say that? Because he enacts true justice. He does. Is there DNA evidence that has been wrong? Yes. How about fingerprints on the murder weapon? Yes. All kinds of things. This has happened over and over again. God says two. You must acquit. I got it memorized. Victim must be satisfied by law of restitution. So God says, look, when someone has a crime committed against them, justice means that the victim gets restitution. Somebody is robbed, they get it back plus. According to God's standard, if somebody stole your car, you have to give them two. Two. How quickly do you think that stealing would drop off if we started enacting what God's standard was, his example? So you didn't get to go to prison and get fed and get an education and be protected. You actually had to go and work so many jobs that you had to pay that guy back until you could have had anything. And the government's not going to put you in housing. It's up to you. You want to live in a tent? You're under the bridge? That's the way it is. You're going to have to do that until you pay that guy back because you stole. Forms of punishment include death, banishment, confiscation, imprisonment, and slavery. Does God say that slavery is okay? Yes, and so does the U.S. Constitution. Article 13 says it. I'm sorry, 13th Amendment says it. What's it say? Slavery is illegal except for punishment of a crime. That's what the 13th Amendment says. What would be slavery? Forced to do something you don't want to do, like make license plates in prison. That's slavery. The Bible says it's okay. Death, banishment, confiscation, but the punishment must fit the crime. That's justice. Punishment must fit the crime by laws. So it can't be up to the judge to determine what fits the crime. It has to be a law. We have to have a law that says if this crime's committed, this is the punishment. Why? Because maybe you catch the judge on a bad day. Or maybe you catch him on too good of a day. I feel magnanimous today. You murdered? Yeah. Go serve 10 hours of community service. You won't do it again, right? Is that proper? That's not proper. That's not justice, is it? Not justice. By the way, what does God say the punishment, the payment is, the penalty is for murder? That's it right there. Death. Why? Lots of people are against capital punishment. Unfortunately, I hear a lot of Christians that say take the same position. Why would we kill them? God's love. Why? Or the family of the one that was killed says, it's not going to bring any justice to us if that person's put to death. We forgive them. Well, it's great that you forgive them, but you can't forgive them. God can forgive them. That's it. That's it. But even if you're forgiven as a believer, guess what? Death. There are consequences for your action. There are consequences. And the reason that someone is put to death, because they have become God. They took someone's life, a person created in his own image, and they took authority to themselves to end that life. That's why it is such a severe consequence. Because once they have taken God's place to determine who should live and who should not live, they no longer have the right to live themselves. That's why. So it's nothing to do with making the family feeling better. It's nothing to do with vengeance for the person that was killed. It's because they violated God's most stringent law for how we interact with each other. Thou shalt not kill. You murder somebody, that's it. You give up your right to life. You no longer have that right. There is no right. Not because we say it, because God says it. All right, so we're going to end there. We're not going to go into this, but this is the first paragraph, which we'll pick up next week. We'll start covering with the first paragraph of the law, and this is all just introduction today. So let's close in a word of prayer.